Hello and welcome to Nerdy Boys Reviews. We're your hosts. I'm Nerdy Boy Scott.
And I'm Nerdy Boy Christian.
This is your weekly nerd podcast where we review the new and old in nerd movies. Explicit content warning, this podcast may not be suitable for all listeners of all ages. Material on this podcast has been deemed to be vulgar, rude, and sometimes even crude. So you have been warned. What up, what up, what up, my nerdy peeps? How's it going, everybody? Hope everybody's had a great week. Because, you know, the Nerdy Boys probably did too.
Christian? Probably, yeah.
Christian.
Yes.
How you doing, mate?
Brilliant.
That's good.
Yeah.
To know. So, everyone, as the intro stated, this is Film Review Friday. Wah, wah,
wah. Yeah, we will be focusing on the film Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. We reviewed the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone, depending on where you are geographically, last week. And if you're interested in that, go listen to it. This is part two, pretty much. We'll be talking about Chamber of Secrets. We're just going to pretty much get into it because we are on a bit of a time crunch. Don't make me laugh too much because I have to shit.
All right.
Oh, Jesus. God. Are you okay?
I am all right. So, Harry Potter and Chamber of Secrets, what did you think?
This is the longest of the Harry Potter films, nearly 3 hours of runtime. Shortest books. Yeah, this book is about 85,000 words. By comparison, Order of Phoenix is like 500,000 words or something. It's ridiculous. And it's like one of the shorter movies. It's like, when you get into it, I mean, the length of a book doesn't necessarily translate to the length of a movie. Like, people want to say, oh, the longer the book, the longer the movie should be. But, it just depends on how you adapt it. Christopher Columbus is in the nature of adapting films to follow the story of the book. You can make a tighter-focused Harry Potter film, and it'll find the heart of the story rather than follow the beat by beat of the story. But when you do that, it feels a little less like Harry Potter. This movie does feel authentically Harry Potter.
Yes.
But those are like the sacrifices you make when you make adaptive choices. And I'll talk about some of my favorite adaptive choices in a little bit that, you know, you do lose some things, but they work better. If you grade the film on feeling and looking like a Harry Potter movie, it is a brilliant success. I'm still not a fan of the way Christopher Columbus adapts films, but what did you think?
I thought the film was brilliant. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean. Yeah, I'm a big Harry Potter fan. I'm not going to sit there and be like, oh, it was a terrible movie, because I didn't think it was a terrible movie. I thought it was great.
Yeah, for me, it's if you're looking for something with deep, rich characters and a deep narrative, you're not necessarily gonna find it. You know, this movie works well as an accompaniment to the text, to the book. It doesn't work well on its own.
I disagree.
Okay.
I disagree.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nothing further. Just disagree.
No, I mean, I think it is a very rich story. In fact, I think it does explore into a whole nother level of the Harry Potter world at Hogwarts. You get like a better understanding for just the world of wizarding and like the depths that it goes to. You get introduced to new creatures of the mystical variety, a basilisk and a phoenix. Pretty badass.
Yeah.
You get flying cars in this. I mean, it just shows like a whole different scope of the wizarding world, and it gives you like that greater, understanding into the world that they live in.
No, I won't argue that. I just think, anytime you make a movie based on a book or anything, you're going to lose some character depth, some character growth, things like that. But you really do miss it with these first two films a lot, more so than in the other films, I think. But because we kind of move very quickly from plot to plot, like beat to beat to beat. It's like action, action, action. And honestly, it takes forever to get like from the beginning to when they finally go to Hogwarts. Mm-hmm. But like to when the tree the Fort Anglia crashes into the Whomping Willow, it takes forever. But it doesn't feel like it takes forever because this story just moves so fast. You don't really ever.
It's so entertaining as well. I mean, and there's obviously differences, you know, from book to movie.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In this, but you know, like for most of the part, it's all the same. It's just necessarily like a few things were cut, and you know, like for instance, in the book, Fred and George actually go into the house and go into the cupboard to get Harry Potter's suitcase. Yeah. I don't know why I call him by his first name. I mean, it's his full name. to go get the suitcase, but, you know, the suitcase was already there. Those are things, you know, that aren't necessarily important to the story. And I feel in order to grow certain characters, they had to switch who was doing certain things.
Right.
You know, for instance, Hermione's not the person who saved him from the Bludger in the books.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. There are some of the other things that they took out completely. We don't get any of the exposition about Filch being a squib and being a potential target for the basilisk. We don't get any of the subplot between Percy and Penelope. We don't really get anything about Percy at all in this movie too much.
We don't really get much about Percy in any of them, really. Like, yeah. I mean, in other the books, than like
we get a lot about. Well, Percy. Yeah. I mean, it's very entertaining, to be honest, but. We kind of lose some of the motivation for Harry's detention with Lockhart. We don't get
why did he get detention? I'm having a hard time remembering. What was it for?
It was
because he got dueling, caught.
Like because he was talking to the snake or something, and wasn't it?
No, it's because he got caught. Remember being outside of like out at night.
No, I don't think that was it.
Yeah, because remember Snape caught him. Either. I'm pretty sure that's the reason.
I think it was actually when they were like found like with one of like the petrified students or something, like in the halls whatever. I'm pretty sure that was it. But yeah, we lose almost all the foreshadowing from the book about Ginny's involvement with the Chamber of Secrets, and the one bit we do get is like almost works against it, where like Harry's in the library talking about. Something and she or when because after he talked to the snake in the dueling session and she gives him the actress Bonnie White who plays Jenny just gives him this amazing like look and it's a great look but you know she's like staring at him like in a weird way and then he goes out and sees nearly headless Nick petrified and one of the students petrified so it's like almost like you would never say oh well Jenny's involved because how could she be involved with that because she's the one who sticks the basilisk on these people
right
when she's in the library at that time so you know. In the book, we get a lot of, like, foreshadowing. This is all pretty much cut out, but that doesn't really bother me at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only argument that I would call valid, but even in the end, like, you do get the motivation behind it. You know, it just you have to wait to find out why exactly Jenny was the, you know.
Yeah, yeah. The climax of this movie works way better for me in the movie than it does in the book. Way right. better. But one of the things, so... For me, because it moves so fast, it's so the pacing is a bit frantic. You don't really get, you know, any time to feel like the sense of impending danger, the sense of impending doom, because it just moves so fast. You don't get time to sit there and think. You just kind of
What do you mean? No,
in my opinion, you don't.
I would disagree with that because you get like the whole time of them trying to find the answer. In the library, they're trying to find like the textbook, and then like they're trying to make the potion to find out who's controlling it. And like within those moments, you do get the time to like you know you get like the understanding of how dangerous this creature is. Because at first they don't even know that it's a basilisk, but you know.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, for me, it just moves so fast. Like you don't really get a chance to connect with Harry. You don't. Like, one of the things that's much different in the movie than the book is you don't get him really questioning his identity, his who he is as a person, whereas in the book you get this major complex character arc where, you know, is he the heir of Slytherin? Should he be a Slytherin? And we do get the great scene in the movie with the sorting hat where he talks to it at the end or while he's waiting for right. Dumbledore in the office or whatever. And that's great, but we don't get...
Well, I think that was more or less played out in the first movie then. If you want to talk about that,
not really. He doesn't really struggle with his identity in the same way.
I don't think it's necessarily as important because obviously he knows he's not the heir of Slytherin.
I think it's just we don't get that rich characterization. And that's, you know, that's...
I don't know, man. Like,
maybe you can call it a nitpick, or you can call it what you want.
Exactly.
To me, like... that.
It doesn't change anything in the story, though.
So, this is one thing I found, like, watching the films, and not just these two, all the Harry Potter films, is that I'll watch them, you know, and haven't read the books for a while, and I'll go back to the book, and it's just, it's so much richer for the characters.
Okay,
and,
well, that's obvious. Any adaptation, you can never fully get 100% an adaptation. And like we've always talked about, dude, if you want the book, go read the book. You need to accept a film for what it is. It's an adaptation.
I do,
and
but...
In exactly how you explained it to me last week, it's an adaptation. It's something that is you know, follows the story, but it changes things in order to fit on screen. So to say, oh, yeah, we lost some of this, of course, you're going to lose bits and pieces here and there. Obviously, we know you cannot make a 100% perfect adaptation.
Right. For me, it's he made the decision more for the story than for the characters, and I think... that falls short. I mean, there are adaptions that do a phenomenal job of having rich, deep characterization. Maybe different from the books.
I think they did fine on that, honestly. And there are points within the story that, you know, I don't think that we necessarily make Harry question it, but they make everyone else question it, which has almost the same impact. After the duel, everybody's like, you know, talking about him in secret and everything like that. And then you have at the end when he's talking to the Sorting Hat, and then you have in the first movie when, you know, the Sorting Hat said, oh, are you sure you don't want to be a Slytherin? That's a foreshadow, in my opinion.
It's very brief, though, is the point.
But
you know,
exactly, that's what foreshadows are, though. They're brief moments that could lead to something, you know?
Perhaps. I think we're just going to disagree on it. I there's not a whole lot to say beside, you know, to me. Like, in the characters that suffer the most from it are Snape and McGonagall. Like, they're completely... They suffer a lot in the films.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Something that I feel that was, like, poorly handled... And I don't even necessarily know if it was different, because, oh, man, it's been so long since I read The Chamber of Secrets. Like, years... since I read that one.
Right.
Fox. They explain, right? He says he knows something along the lines of, it doesn't make sense how Fox appears to Harry in the chambers. It does not make sense. It literally doesn't make sense. I try to read some theories on it and things, and even with those theories, it's just... you can only, exactly as you say, it's like you can only know what you're given in the text.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And nothing is ever given in the text that says, you know, all they say is he can sense people who are loyal to Dumbledore. Because the Phoenix is loyal to Dumbledore. The Phoenix, as you learn later, has like the little transportation abilities and stuff, and transports Dumbledore out and gets Dumbledore out of Azkaban as well. And as Fox, I don't know, it just kind of bugs me a little bit as just like a plot device. It's like it's such contrived thing.
In the book more so than the movie, to be honest.
It's very contrived because it's like, oh yeah, go figure. The one thing that can heal a basilisk, poison is the tears of a phoenix. Oh yeah, and look, it appears out of nowhere. No real explanation with the Sorting Hat and to give Harry the Sword of Gryffindor.
Yeah.
And although a great moment, don't get me wrong, and all that's great, but if you really think about it, it's like, it's so confusing. How does he know that Harry's down there? Like, it doesn't really make sense.
Right. I mean, you kind of have to do a bit of whistling with Fox, especially in the book. In the movie, to be honest, that is one of the pieces of adaptation that works the best for me. The way that they handled it, not necessarily because, you know, how do you explain how he knows Harry's down there, blah, blah, blah. But in the book, it does feel like it's just Fox is this tool. He's just this counterpoint, like Tom and his basilisk versus Harry and his phoenix, you know?
Right,
like,
exactly.
And that's what it seems like, because you get this, you know, in the book, Harry, fights the basilisk, kills it. The phoenix comes in, heals him, flies away. Then he fights Tom in the diary and whatever. But in the movie, he destroys the diary first and revives Ginny, kills Tom, or the fragment of Tom. We can't really talk about Horcruxes at this point. You know, and it's obvious this is, at this point, it wasn't intended to be a Horcrux, but when...
Or maybe it was.
Well, you'd have to do a lot of whistling to get to that because,
why would Tom have
his diary in the one place where the one thing that can destroy it is the basilisk, is basilisk venom? He'd obviously know that he'd never put the diary anywhere near one of the only living basilisks in the world. Like,
well... Okay, but the thing is, Voldemort has this super god complex, right? Like, he has this huge ego, right? Throughout every story. Because he has to be the one that kills Harry Potter. But if you think about it, like, it's very contrived in that way. The entire story is very contrived in that way. Because the basilisk should have killed Harry. It should have.
Yeah. To be honest, in the movie, this scene goes on far too long. Some of these scenes in the movie drag out.
So disturbing to me. I don't mind the
snake. Like, and I think it's actually a pretty cool sequence, but it just goes on for so
long. Well, I mean, I was
long.
Like a kid when I watch it, and if you guys never knew this, but like I'm deathly afraid of snakes. And so like that scene, like when he's like chasing like Harry through the tunnels and then he has him cornered and he's like, I'm going to fucking kill you. And I was like a kid. I was like, run, Harry.
Yeah, that scene just goes on forever.
Yeah.
But yeah, to me, this bit of adaption works so well because, you know, like I said, in the book, it's just like, you know, basilisk poisons Harry. Harry kills basilisk. Phoenix saves Harry. Harry kills Tom. You know, and it's all very,
right.
You know, but in the book or in the movie.
In the book, it happens in a different order, though.
Yeah. In the movie, he destroys the diary. Ginny wakes up. He says, go save Ron. Get out of here. The first real bit of selfless heroism we get from Harry, you know, where,
right.
You know, he's I'm going to die. You get yourself to safety. Find Ron. Get out of here. And it's almost like because the phoenix flies in after that, like that's a reward for his heroism, you know, as opposed to just, you know, oh, basilisk bites him. Now you're healed. Now you fight Tom, you know, like
right.
it's so much richer, I think, in this movie. Like in the book, the phoenix literally drops the diary in Harry's lap, you know,
right.
Like it is pretty contrived. In the movie, we get structural surgery that strengthens the scene. Harry gets a moment of genuine selfless heroism. And his character is truly tested. His kindness and generosity is tested, and it shows. You know, we get Foxy comes heals him, and it's like almost a reward for his selflessness and kindness. And to me, it's one of the best bits of adaptation in this
right.
film. Some of the other things that worked really well for me. Some of my favorite adaptive choices. So after Draco calls Hermione a mudblood, she gets to explain what that means, and that's so rich because you know that she's heard it before. You know she knows what it means. Whereas in the book,
character.
Right. Well, you know,
development.
Yes. That's why these work for me. That's why it works for me. We lose a bit of Ron. Ron gets pretty shafted throughout this story, to be honest. He kind of gets relegated to be comic relief in a way. Whereas he has a bigger role in the book.
Yeah. I mean,
we lose him sticking up for Hermione's honor in this because he knows what it means and she doesn't and all this stuff. We lose a bit of that, but it's so worth it just to get her like this deep kind of richness from Hermione that I love so much.
Right. But even it's like that's like classic Ron though. It's like, you know, he has a broken wand and he goes to cast, you know, something on Malfoy and then it backfires and he's the one throwing up the stuff. It all worked in harmony in my opinion. It's like it was perfect. The way they set it up and I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, especially because it's one of the first bit out of both of these films of vulnerability we get from Hermione. And that to me, it's just so good. So, all
right. So I just want to readdress the Fox thing, right? So, all right, I was reading this thing on Reddit, of course, on Reddit, right?
Fucking Reddit.
Ugh, God damn it, Reddit. All right, so the question is, you know, I had the same thing, you know, how did Fox know that the Chamber of Secrets, where the Chamber of Secrets was located, and why, it's like so many things are lost and you don't know. It's like, did it communicate this with Dumbledore? How did this all happen? Like, and this guy was like, said, what makes you think Dumbledore didn't know about the chamber? though they were actively looking for it in the movie, dumbass. What makes you think it wasn't Dumbledore's choice not to come to Harry's aid? Look, there's an uncomfortable truth you're going to have to accept first. Dumbledore was very much a big picture guy. His vast intelligence and magical powers allowed him to examine events from a perspective that most people wouldn't see. He knew Harry would be needed for Voldemort's ultimate defeat. He also knew that Harry would need to willingly face his own death and not turn away from his purpose when the time came. Therefore, during Harry's growth and development, it became necessary to test Harry's courage, ingenuity, strength, and the strength of will. This is why Dumbledore allowed Harry so much freedom to explore and get into mischief during the schooling years. This is why Dumbledore allows Harry to take on the challenges he did, challenges that far exceed anything that would be considered reasonable for a schoolboy of his age. You know, he just kind of goes on and on and on. What do you think about that? Dumbledore knew where the chamber was?
No.
Absolutely not. Because if he did, he would have went down there to defeat the Basilisk himself.
If Dumbledore knew there was a basilisk in the pipes and in under the school, he would have dealt with it. Like, he's not like, oh, I'm just going to let him take all these half-bloods and muggle-born children and squibs and stuff and petrify them because I want Harry to deal with this. That's not what happened. And to the comment about, oh, you know, he knew Harry was going to have to deal with this. He didn't. Nobody knew that Voldemort was for sure coming back. They knew.
Right.
They knew that his presence was still there and it was possible he could. But he can't play favorites. Dumbledore can't just, you know, be like, oh, Harry, like, and, you know, you're going to be my favorite student, and I'm going to take you under my wing and do it. He has to treat him like every other student.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, sure, great theory, but I don't agree with it. You remind me of the Jar Jar Binks theory people, so.
Hey, now. Let's not take any unnecessary jabs there, friend.
It's a very interesting theory. Very interesting.
Very interesting. I disagree with it wholeheartedly. I mean, first off, how would he know that Harry would have to be the one that needs to deal with it? I mean, just to sit there and say, oh, his vast intellect and magical prowess gave him the insight.
Title.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, dude, fuck off. All right.
It is. I mean, that's...
His name is on the title, yeah, in, you know, when it's introduced to us. But these characters live in the actual world.
Right. Yeah, Harry is special. We know Harry's special. He forces the action. He is our protagonist. He makes things happen, right? That's what your protagonist does. You know, and he never does anything, you know, great because he is selfless and all this until we get that at the end with Ginny, but you know, he is curious and he pushes everything forward. And obviously he's going to be the subject of things, but Dumbledore doesn't know Harry is going to save the school from the Basilisk. Dumbledore
right.
doesn't know that. Anybody could have done that. Lockhart, you know, that great, you know, guy there, the Defense Against the Dark Arts
hell,
teacher.
Snape could have took on the Basilisk, I feel like.
Well, yeah, Snape could have taken on the Basilisk.
But Dumbledore, obviously, if he would have known, he's like one of the greatest wizards of all time. Hell, McGonagall, dude, she's so strong. She is such a powerful witch.
Yeah, I mean... They would never let a student deal with this to begin with, first of all, right?
Come on, guys.
Like, only Hagrid, who says, go meet the giant spiders in the forest, you know, is that irresponsible.
Yeah,
you
I know? Mean, but Hagrid is Hagrid, and
yeah,
we don't question Hagrid's methods.
So, we get two major sources of phobias in this movie. We get snakes and spiders. Do spiders bother you?
No.
Did
no.
these spiders bother you?
No.
There you go. Spiders... don't bother
oh,
me that
that's
much,
another
but.
Thing. You know, I was also reading online how the car, it's a contrived, you know, plot tool, was the means about how they get onto the grounds and then gets beat up by the Whomping Willow, you know, to just activate itself and then roll off into the woods and then magically be there when they're in time of need.
I mean, yeah, you
what
can
you,
you can you can paint it as contrived. I think, like, there's a more interesting argument about, you know, where Ron gets his line from the book where he says, the force has made it wild, you know, and, you know, if that is a part of its sentience or whatever, like, you know, things like that. I think that's a very interesting conversation to have. It would take a while, you know, I could probably talk about it for an hour or so, but it is a bit contrived, but we do see it drive into the forest in one of the extended scenes or deleted scenes from the film, not in its theatrical release, but, you know, if you own the movie, you see it drive into the forest.
Right. Right.
So, you know, it will be there, but for it to come and save them and all this, you can easily see how it's contrived. I think that's another scene that just goes on way too long where they're escaping the forest. Yeah. So, I mean, yes, this movie and its theatrical 2 hours and 40 minute runtime. Like, I don't mind long movies, you know, but
there were some things that could have been cut down or, you know, broadened.
Which is
a lot of the things, though. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, yeah, when you say things like that, like, this is where the following movies suffer, is we can distill down Harry Potter into we can distill the story down, right? Simple, make it shorter, but we would lose a lot of what makes Harry Potter Harry Potter,
right?
Which is I don't mind the later films. I know that's a major complaint for, I know you don't, probably Prisoner of Azkaban for that reason. Goblet of Fire probably suffers the most from that. But yeah, we're talking about Chamber of Secrets, guys.
So there, I mean, obviously some differences from the book to movie, obviously, you know, like we said, we can't get 100%, but I feel like for the most part, it's pretty, you know, like it's really like almost like spot on, right? And the things that they did change, you know, were like minor, and I think it almost worked into their favor, you know, not developing Fred and George quite as much as they are in the book, because they're actually like semi-important characters, you know, as the story goes on. They're not just like there in the background in the school like they are in the movies. Like they're around quite a bit. Right. And then there's like the Dobby thing, whereas like it happened differently. Whereas the people that Vernon was making the deal with, that Dobby dropped the cake on the lady's head, they left because they didn't like birds. And Hedwig was going all crazy, and they're like, all right, we're out of here pretty much. But they changed it into Dobby, you know, trying to stop Harry from going to, I mean, he's doing that in the book anyways, but like the way it all kind of went down is different, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But those are changes that like, I don't mind. I think that they worked and they're funny and, you know.
Yeah. Dobby works for me.
I think
I don't know if Dobby works for a lot of adults. Like, I think he's meant to get kids interested. Kids love creatures like that. That's what Jar Jar Binks was meant for. I don't know.
I don't think that that's what he was meant for.
Maybe I mean, not. You know, like
technically, most of weren't these all children's books?
The first two are much more juvenile, not in a condescending or pedantic sense, but they're more meant for kids. The first two books, you have a definite identifiable tonal shift as you move forward into book three.
Right.
But yeah, the first two books are definitely kids, more towards like middle school kind of kids. Then we move into more like a young adult, but very tonally dark, story.
Yeah.
As we move forward. But yeah. Yeah. One of the things that worked well for me also. So, the Polyjuice potion in the book, Crabbe and Goyle, their voices don't still have Harry and Ron's voices.
Right.
Which makes sense because your voice is a part of your biology. It should change, right? And then when you get Mad-Eye Moody later with Barty Crouch, you know,
right,
that's kind of like a change, you know, kind of a retcon in a way. But it works well in this because, God, those actors were phenomenal. The guys who played Crabbe and Goyle.
Yeah.
To, like, do that kind of, like, pantomime Mad Lib thing with Harry and Ron's voices. But yeah, they do a great job, and I think it works great because it puts Harry and Ron under this added pressure in this scene to try to get the information out of Draco, because with Crabbe and Goyle's voices, it'd be way too easy, you know?
Right.
And it has this kind of comedic approach that really serves the scene well. That's like one of the best pieces of adaption, I think.
Oh, and kind of building off of that, right? So the Polyjuice potion, this is what I'm talking about, cutting unnecessary things out of the story that makes no difference. So obviously we know that Hermione turns basically into a cat, and she, in the book, she spends so much time in the recovery process from that.
Yeah.
Like, she spends a lot of time in the hospital wing trying to get better from that, and we don't get any of that in the book. I mean, in the movie, because we don't need that. That does nothing.
Yeah, the book really sidelines Hermione for the story because they have to, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
Because she would have just figured it out like that. They had to sideline her with a cat thing and then being petrified. They kind of had to. But the other thing, right, when we get the flashback 50 years ago, and Tom is talking to, in the book, Professor Dippet.
Yeah.
They changed that for the movie, and he's talking to a young Professor Dumbledore.
Yeah.
And that works so much better because it draws this connection between Tom and Dumbledore that's meant to mirror the connection between Harry and Dumbledore.
Right.
And it's like, that works. That works. Right. I love that.
Exactly.
And we get like this great like noir style filming with all these Dutch angles, and it just works really well for me.
Yeah. There's a lot of things to love about like some of the adaptations that
Christopher Columbus.
Yeah, yes.
Chris Columbus, sorry. Yeah, hey. Christopher Columbus quote unquote discovered America.
fake news. anyways, Chris Columbus, yes, sorry. There's so many things to like about the adaptations that he did do. I mean, obviously there's things that could have been, I think the number one gripe for me, right? Is this the Fox thing? It you know, still bugs me.
Yeah.
It's like, how? I mean, what? It doesn't really make sense. They give like a brief explanation of like they can sense. So what do? Fly all the way down there? Like, did nobody see a fucking phoenix just flying around the school and decide not to follow it? I mean,
right.
Or did it, you know, teleport? Because in this one you don't even
we don't understand the mechanics of the phoenix.
Yeah, I mean the phoenix. Those are a different time. We'll talk about that in another podcast.
Yeah,
eventually when we get to those movies. Anywho.
Yeah. One of the things to note is this is the last time we'll see Sir Richard Harris as Dumbledore.
Right.
We get
he was so good.
He passed away, unfortunately, a week before the premiere of this film.
Yeah.
But he did an amazing job. We're going to get a major tonal change to Dumbledore moving forward. We get that a little bit in the book. But, you know, one of the things people like to point out is the part of text in Goblet of Fire where it says, "Did you put your name in the Goblet of Fire?" He said calmly. And then show the clip of him, "Did you put your name in the Goblet of Fire?"
But it works so much better that way, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, would he say it calmly? Like, I mean, I think the Sir Richard Harris version of him probably would, but the fiery, angsty version of Dumbledore.
Michael Gambon.
Yeah.
Who a lot of people might have problems with. He works for me sometimes. He doesn't work for me other times, but we'll talk about that when we get to him. But Richard Harris just does a phenomenal job as Dumbledore.
I think they're just two different Dumbledores, just completely different
acting styles. They're probably written differently. Direction is different. All this stuff.
Yeah, like Sir Chris Harris was like, he was like an ominous kind of like mystery version of Dumbledore. Like,
right? Yeah, he was more the classic kind of wizard in a way.
Very reserved.
Michael Gambon is much different, but yeah, I love what we get from Richard Harris in the first two films. I think he's phenomenal. He brings such a sense of everything. Like the way he acts is like amazing. It's so ambiguous the way he is.
Right.
I love it. And we get the great, you know, the classic end scene where he's talking to Harry, you know,
yeah.
Just like we got at the end of the first film. And I just love it.
And then we get, you know, the whole Dobby sock and awesomeness.
Yeah.
So I guess kind of move into ratings. So I want to do two parts as just a film. Don't correlate between the books and everything like that. Just a film. What would you rate it? Like,
I think it's a delightful film. Just like the first one, I'd give it a C- as just a film.
A C- as just a film.
Yeah, if you don't connect it to the book at all, it loses a lot. It works really well alongside the book, I think. Without the book, without the knowledge of the book, I don't think it works very well for a lot of people.
I would disagree with that. I think it works just fine.
I mean, we're going to disagree on that. I mean, there's really nothing to say. I just think you gain a lot from knowing the book material.
Well, I think that's with any story, though.
But
that's any story.
Disconnect it completely from the book. No knowledge of the book doesn't work as well. Not nearly as well.
I don't see how, though.
So, I mean, we're going to talk about Prisoner of Azkaban, but that story of the movie functions well on its own without any knowledge of the book, but it loses a lot people would say it loses a lot because it does function as its own narrative. This doesn't function as its own narrative. It works very well as a companion to the book. It doesn't work well on its own.
I disagree with that, man. I don't know. I don't see the same thing that you see in it.
Yeah,
I don't know. Just major. All right. Now here's the second part. How would you how do you compare it as an adaptation to the book in comparison to the first movie?
It does pretty much the same. It makes a little more decisions than the first one did. It makes some more changes than the first one, but largely it follows the same pattern. It tries to largely mirror the plot points and the beats of the story and loses a lot of the deep characterization, but I think it works a little better than what Sorcerer's Stone did. And I think it can. I think it can because, like I said last week, he had to be very conservative with what he did with Sorcerer's Stone because he didn't want people to hate it. Like, it was a massive undertaking for Chris Columbus, so he was really afraid to take major risks with that film.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, that was very successful. I think that movie had a $150 million budget. The second one only had a $100 million budget, but they had, you know, all the effects and stuff that they could reuse from the first one.
Right.
Sorcerer's Stone made over $800 million, like $900 million. This movie made like $750 million, so a little less, but you spent a little less on it. So, I mean, either way, this movie was going to make money because of the success of the first film. So I think he felt more comfortable making more of those decisions.
Nice.
Yeah. So what did you think? Like, do you, I know we disagree on how well it works alone, but do you agree that it does work better as a companion to the book than just on its own?
No. I disagree with that. I don't think that you need to read the books to understand what happens in the story. Yeah, I think it does. It gives you more insight, of course, but that's with any story because obviously you lose things from the original text. But I feel like that's such like an unfair statement to say, though. You know, it's like of course. It makes it better if you have the insider knowledge of every little thing, you know? But that's like, for instance, all right, say like, let me try to explain it to you this way, right? So you decide to pick up a new comic book. You mm-hmm. decide, I'm going to start with this one, and you read through everything, but there's like this brief little mention of maybe something that happened before. Do you need then to have to read whatever came before in order to understand everything that happened in the story? I don't think so.
See, I'm not saying you have to necessarily read the book to understand the story.
That not what exactly you're saying?
I'm saying that the book, like this movie, doesn't necessarily stand on its own. It's not a story unto itself. It just tries to be the book. That's what it's trying to do. It's not trying to.
Well, that's fine. I think a better statement, in my opinion. I mean, you can have your own opinion. You can think that, but sometimes I just try to understand like where exactly like you come from. And, like, I don't know. It's like maybe I don't know if you're saying like the right thing that you're meaning to say. But I think a better statement may be that the book enhances your experience of the movie. I think that's a fair statement. Obviously, it does, you know? But to say that it can't stand alone, because there's plenty of people probably out there that are fans of just the movie and that probably have never even read the books.
That's true, yeah. I mean, I'm not disputing that. What I'm saying is, I'll try to phrase this in a way, but an adaptation should be its own story, and it should take the essence of the book and show it in a different medium, really. And that's, I mean, the classic definition of an adaptation. Okay. What these movies do is they just try to show what's in the book on screen. Okay. And make very few adaptive choices. And when you do that, you're making essentially just the book all over again. And so what I'm saying is, yeah, it is the book story with a couple different things here and there, and yeah, and it works as a companion piece in a way to where, you know, you get a little. It's like you're getting more information about the book through the movie, or you're getting more information about the movie through the book, or whatever. Whereas an adaption itself, by definition, should function on the same overall story, but the plot should change or should seek to enhance things in a different way. It should try to find more depth. It should try to do something more.
But the thing is, right, is like the, I mean, I watched the movies before I read the books.
Right.
And I understood everything. Had no problem with understanding anything that happened except for Fox.
Right.
That's just something that just annoys me still. Like, and even if you read the books, it doesn't explain it properly.
Yeah,
you have anyways,
to whistle in the book for sure.
Yeah. But no. Like, what I'm saying is, it doesn't matter if it's trying to mirror what happens in the book. It still stands on its own, and it's still a good product.
I think it
gives you a greater enjoyment if you know what happens in the story. But that's with anything. That's like us watching the CW shows. We get a greater enjoyment because we read those comic books.
Right. But without having read them, like, you can still really enjoy them. You can understand them fully.
You can understand these films as well.
I think you can, but, you know, like, I don't know. It doesn't work necessarily. Like,
but it does.
For me, you lose a lot of the connection and the depth that you get from.
But see, that's what I'm saying.
But
you're
looking
for a carbon copy.
No.
But you are, though, because you're literally saying this isn't good enough because you're losing meaning here and here and here. So essentially what you're saying is you just wanted the movie to be, I mean, the book to be plastered into the movie, 100% detail, 100% story, and it's physically, you cannot do that. The only way you could do that is if you start to split up each book into like several movies. The only way you could do it.
For me, the way I, the connection I'll draw is you don't get a lot of comic book stories necessarily in the comic book movies. But they nail the character work. And that is, like, to me, the perfect meaning of an adaption is when you get to the heart of it, what these people represent, what they symbolize, and you make a story that works around that rather than, you know, kind of just going plot point to plot point to plot point to plot point and never really giving the audience a chance to catch their breath. And that's...
Well, I don't know, man. Like, I it's totally like, disagree. Like, there is plenty of time to do all of that, you know.
See,
you have the apologies potion scenes, you have the Quidditch scenes, you have the opening, you know, them traveling into the school scenes type of things.
So to me,
you have the forest scene. Those are all scenes that take a break from the main plot.
Well,
the main story.
Those are all advancing the main story as well, you know.
I mean, that's the point of everything, right?
Right, like, right.
But they're not directly, you know, going from, you know, the basilisk to the chamber to, you know, fighting to that. There's things that happen in between that give you the break, the comedic relief that you need, and, you know, the distraction from the plot that gives it a greater story.
I can see how you can argue that. To me, right, it's really difficult because I'm looking for things like not necessarily carbon copy, like you're saying from the book. I'm looking for the thematic elements that like parts like that, which you can't really see a lot of in the movie. You know, you don't get a lot of that thematic or narrative weight or you know, a lot of depth to it. And maybe that's just, you know, me not like this is just critically, right? Critically looking at it. On the surface.
But you're looking, but you keep saying like, I'm not looking for a carbon copy, but you're looking for the same depth that you experience in the books. You're looking for that in the movie. That's literally just saying, I want the carbon copy.
Or something different. I mean, you can draw the comparison with Captain America like I do. I don't get a lot of depth from Captain America in comics, but the films, you get a lot of depth about who he is and what he stands for. Aragorn is the same. They give him this massive vulnerability in the movies that you don't get at all in the books. You know, you can make these changes and strengthen your characters by doing so. And that's what I feel is missing a bit from these first two films is you're not getting a lot of that. Like, to me, maybe it's just me. Maybe it is. I don't know. I can't speak to anybody else's experience, right. But I don't connect with Harry the way I feel I should. You know, I don't feel this connection to Harry that you're supposed to.
But look, okay, you can take each character and you can make the connections within the things that happen in the movies, right? So Harry, he's inherently special, but he's a lonely person. He has no family. He feels like an outcast, an outsider. Those are deeper emotional connections that you can make in the movies. Hermione, like, she's this super smart person, but she has no friends. Yeah, exactly. Except for them. No, like, and even Ron didn't like her at first because she was very snobby. She was very uptight. All these things that, you know, eventually she, grows up a little bit and all those things. But those are emotional and deep-seated connections. And same with Ron. You have, you know, this quirky, fun-loving guy, essentially. But, you know, his family is broke. And a lot of times, you know, they play, you know, especially with Malfoy, they play, you know, the character, you know, down just because they're poor and things like that. And you get those senses. It's like those moments there, like you have to, you know, grab them when they're actually there.
Yeah, I just don't feel like the movie gives you time to make those connections. Like, and again, that could be untrue for some people. I don't feel like I have any time to connect with Harry or anything. And if you can't connect to the characters, then you're completely disconnected from the film, the plot, and the story. And you just don't care. And I think that can leave people feeling cold if they feel the same way. Maybe they don't. Maybe I'm just this outsider who's thinking way too critically about it, and that's entirely possible.
I would agree with that statement. I don't see how you don't connect with Harry. Like, how do you not connect with him at all?
You connect with him because, again, his name is in the title, but...
Yeah, and obviously he's our main character. You know, like, I mean, do you not connect with him through, like, his upbringing and, like, the harsh, you know...
You don't get a lot of it, though.
But you do. They literally put bars on his windows and locked him in his room.
Yeah, but that's
never happened. Do you think that's normal? Do you think that is normal?
No, and that does make you feel bad for Harry, but then his friends come and rescue him, like, immediately, you know? Like, I don't know.
The way they, like, treat him like an outcast and, like he should be invisible. They make him hide upstairs. You know what I mean? They don't even want him to let him go to Hogwarts, but they do.
Yeah. You don't really feel the weight of that too much, though, because he gets out of it so quickly, you know?
I don't know, man. Like, I disagree with that. Like you get a lot of people, like, always, like, they're waiting for something to come of Harry. Like, he has, like, this great pressure to be great from everyone. Everybody talks about the boy who lived. And he has all this great pressure on him to do great things.
Well, then his mundanity with the Dursleys should feel like an escape to him.
But,
like...
But, I mean, obviously it is. It is. But anybody can succumb to pressure.
Maybe. I don't feel the pressure in the films about that, though. I just don't feel it. Maybe, again... Maybe I'm the outcast on that.
You know, everybody, like, looks to him, and then everybody starts to turn on him, right? Everybody starts to turn on him as soon as they learn that he can speak to snakes. Nobody knew that before about him, and then in this film that's revealed. Everybody thinks that he's the heir of Slytherin, except for Draco, of course.
Right, but we get great parts in the book where he confronts that. He confronts himself. He questions his identity. We get a really bad extended or a deleted sequence in the movie about it. It's very short and just badly written, in my opinion. But we lose a lot of that in the film. We don't really get him confronting his identity and his sense of self or anything like that. And that's a major part of this, is, like, he may be the heir of Slytherin. And like I said, we get that great sequence where he talks to the Sorting Hat. Well, but that's about it.
I don't know about that, though. I mean, you get that in the movie or whatever, but other than the fact that he can speak to snakes and everything, why would he question it? I never understood that. Like, why would he question it?
Because he has to confront this idea that because he has this connection with Tom Riddle and he can talk to snakes.
But he doesn't know who Tom Riddle is.
No, not at this point he doesn't. You're right, but... The fact that he can talk to snakes And the only other person that can talk to snakes is Voldemort. Right?
Right.
That's a thing. And then, you know, enemies of the air beware kind of thing. Like, all these things, he's drawing these connections between himself and Voldemort.
But wouldn't he think that he would remember unleashing some monster on everyone? Does he think that he's just, like, going into, like, amnesia states and stuff? Like, I mean, like, I don't under— there's no motivation there for him to question. So it's like, well, I feel like Chris Columbus was like, well, I don't see a connection there, so why would we add this into the film? There's no need for it.
You could be right.
You almost, in the film, you know, Harry's always looking for these, like, people that he doesn't like, and he draws, like, the connection to the people that he doesn't like, and he believes that they're the ones, you know, who are behind these, like, menacing acts. You know, first film is he thinks Snape is, you know, trying to get the Sorcerer's Stone, and this one he thinks Draco Malfoy, because there's nobody more sinister and, you know, more of a disgusting person than Draco.
Yeah, he thinks Draco might be the heir or whatever, you know, thought, and then finds out. But, you know, when he talks to the snake, that's not a conscious decision he makes. It just happens. So, you know, it could be this amnesiac, whatever word you want to say, state where he goes into this and doesn't think about it, you know, and then doesn't really know what's going on, doesn't know anything weird about talking to snakes, obviously.
But all playing like a game of like what ifs, right? Like you always talk about, you know, reading the text and you can only analyze what's in the text and stuff.
They
don't give you enough. So what is the honest to God point of putting in the film?
Well, the book gives you a lot more than the film does. And maybe the film already ran for 2 hours and 40 minutes, nearly 3 hours with all the cut scenes that you get on the DVD, right? I couldn't take 5 hours of Chamber of Secrets. I love Harry Potter, but I couldn't take 5 hours of Chamber of Secrets. You could? Yeah. Right in the... Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I don't know. I don't know what else to say about that. I just don't connect the way I think you should with Harry. You disagree. You connect with Harry just fine, right?
Yeah. I mean, not everybody's going to connect with characters the same way and stuff. I'm just trying to bring the point of how you can. You know, I'm not necessarily trying to change your mind. I'm just trying to point them out.
That those are ways that you can. I just don't see that, you know? It's like, to me, that's not... Like, that is what they're trying to tell you. I just don't feel it, you know? So,
whose problem is that?
It's mine. It's mine. I'm just a terrible human being. I can't make personal connections with anyone.
Maybe that is the case.
But, yeah.
But that's between you and your therapist, pal.
Chamber of Secrets for you, better or worse than Sorcerer's Stone?
Ooh, baby. I don't know, man. Oh, so hard. Yeah, it is. Ooh, what do you think? What do you think is a better... Oh, man. Dude, that's a hot...
Sorcerer's Stone delights me much more, I think.
They all delight me. I love the Harry Potter. It's so hard to... Oh, yeah, there's my favorite one.
Well, I'm not asking you favorites. I'm just... to me, they're very similar. They're very, very similar. Not in the specific plot points. In the overall structure, they're very similar. And they are the most juvenile of the series.
I would have to say Sorcerer's Stone's more a favoritism, and for one more simple fact
it's
is
the, like, it's the pure length, mate.
No. I don't care about the length. That doesn't bug me. But the mysticism of it all, like being introduced into the new world and stuff, you get more of the Diagon Alley and things like that. Like you're being introduced to all these things for the very first time. You're being introduced to Hogwarts and the moving staircase, the paintings. You feel this overwhelming, you know, sense of this is a new world, you know?
We also adhere much more in Sorcerer's Stone, the film, to the academic calendar than we do in Chamber of Secrets. They kind of just play fast and loose with the school year.
Right. So,
but yeah, I would agree, but still love both films, obviously. Same. Like I said, I think the book and the movie work really well together. The movie, I think, doesn't stand on its own as well. But we talked about that. You disagree. We have to wrap this up because Scott needs to go to work. So
see ya, motherfuckers.
Please follow us on all of our social media at Nerdy Boys Reviews, nerdyboysreviews.com. Reach out to us, talk to us, and, you know, all that good stuff. Please be
all
sure
that jazz.
To rate, us on iTunes. Subscribe if you haven't already. Share us with your friends. Write us a review, please. If you write us a review, we will shout you out on our podcast. We very much appreciate that. So that is everything we have for you guys on Chamber of Secrets. Thank you for joining us on this Film Review Friday. We are your hosts. I'm Nerdy Boy Christian.
And I'm Nerdy Boy Scott.
And as always, we have one message for you, and that is stay nerdy, boys.